Disc 2. The three children looked eagerly at the weather the next day when they got up. The sun was shining and everything seemed splendid. "Isn't it a marvellous day?" said Anne to George as they dressed. "I'm so looking forward to going to the island."
"Well, honestly, I think really we oughtn't to go," said George unexpectedly.
"Oh, but why?" cried Anne in dismay.
"I think there's going to be a storm or something," said George, looking out to the southwest.
"But, George, why do you say that?" said Anne impatiently. "Look at the sun, and there's hardly a cloud in the sky."
"The wind is wrong," said George. "And can't you see the little white tops of the waves out there by my island? That's always a bad sign."
"Oh, George, it will be the biggest disappointment of our lives if we don't go today," said Anne, who couldn't bear any disappointment, big or small. "And besides," she added artfully, "if we hang about the house afraid of a storm, we shan't be able to have dear old Tim with us."
"Yes, that's true," said George. "All right, we'll go. But mind, if a storm does come, you're not to be a baby. You're to try and enjoy it and not be frightened."
"Well, I don't much like storms," began Anne, but stopped when she saw George's scornful look.
They went down to breakfast, and George asked her mother if they could take their dinner as they had planned.
"Yes," said her mother. "You and Anne can help to make the sandwiches. You boys can go into the garden and pick some ripe plums to take with you. Julian, you can go down to the village when you've done that and buy some bottles of lemonade or ginger beer, whichever you like."
"Ginger pop for me, thanks," said Julian,
and everyone else said the same. They all felt very happy. It would be marvellous to visit the queer little island. George felt happy because she would be with Tim all day. They set off at last, the food in two kit bags. The first thing they did was to fetch Tim. He was tied up in the Fisher boy's backyard. The boy himself was there and grinned at George.
"Morning, Master George," he said.
It seemed so queer to the other children to hear Georgina called Master George.
"Tim's been barking his head off for you. I guess he knew you were coming for him today."
"Of course he did," said George, untying him. He at once went completely mad and tore round and round the children, his tail down and his ears flat.
"He'd win any race if only he was a greyhound," said Julian admiringly. "You could hardly see him for dust. Tim! Hi, Tim! Come and say good morning."
Tim leapt up and licked Julian's left ear as he passed on his whirlwind way. Then he sobered down and ran lovingly by George as they all made their way to the beach. He licked George's bare legs every now and then, and she pulled at his ears gently. They got into the boat, and George pushed off. The fisher boy waved to them.
"You won't be very long, will you?" he called. "There's a storm blowing up. Bad one it'll be, too."
"I know," shouted back George. "But maybe we'll get back before it begins. It's pretty far off yet."
George rowed all the way to the island. Tim stood at each end of the boat in turn, barking when the waves reared up at him. The children watched the island coming closer and closer. It looked even more exciting than it had the other day.
"George, where are you going to land?" asked Julian. "I simply can't imagine how you know your way in and out of these awful rocks. I'm afraid every moment we'll bump into them."
"I'm going to land at the little cove I told you about the other day," said George. "There's only one way to it, but I know it very well. It's hidden away on the east side of the island."
The girl cleverly worked her boat in and out of the rocks, and suddenly, as it rounded a low wall of sharp rocks, the children saw the cove she had spoken of. It was like a natural little harbour, and was a smooth inlet of water running up to a stretch of sand sheltered between high rocks. The boat slid into the inlet and at once stopped rocking, for here the water was like glass and had hardly a wrinkle.
"I say, this is fine," said Julian,
his eyes shining with delight. George looked at him, and her eyes shone too, as bright as the sea itself. It was the first time she had ever taken anyone to her precious island, and she was enjoying it. They landed on the smooth yellow sand.
"We're really on the island," said Anne,
and she capered about, Tim joining her and looking as mad as she did. The others laughed. George pulled the boat high up on the sand.
"Why so far up?" said Julian, helping her. "The tide's almost in, isn't it? Surely it won't come as high as this."
"I told you, I thought a storm was coming," said George. "If one does, the waves simply tear up this inlet, and we don't want to lose our boat, do we?"
"Let's explore the island! Let's explore the island!"
yelled Anne, who was now at the top of the little natural harbour, climbing up the rocks there.
"Oh, do come on!"
They all followed her. It really was a most exciting place. Rabbits were everywhere. They scuttled about as the children appeared, but did not go into their holes.
"Aren't they awfully tame?" said Julian in surprise.
"Well, nobody ever comes here but me," said George, "and I don't frighten them. Tim, Tim, if you go after the rabbits, I'll spank you."
Tim turned big, sorrowful eyes onto George. He and George agreed about every single thing except rabbits. To Tim, rabbits were made for one thing, to chase. He never could understand why George wouldn't let him do this. But he held himself in and walked solemnly by the children, his eyes watching the lolloping rabbits longingly.
"I believe they would almost eat out of my hand," said Julian.
But George shook her head. "No, I've tried that with them," she said. "They won't. Look at those baby ones. Aren't they lovely?"
"Ruff,"
said Tim, agreeing, and he took a few steps towards them. George made a warning noise in her throat, and Tim walked back, his tail down.
"There's the castle," said Julian. "Shall we explore that now? I do want to."
"Yes, we will," said George.
"Look, that is where the entrance used to be, through that big broken archway."
The children gazed at the enormous old archway, now half broken down. Behind it were ruined stone steps leading towards the centre of the castle.
"It had strong walls all round it, with two towers," said George. "One tower is almost gone, as you can see, but the other is not so bad. The jackdaws build in that one every year. They've almost filled it up with their sticks."
As they came near to the better tower of the two, the jackdaws circled round them with loud cries of,
"Jack! Jack! Jack!"
Tim leapt into the air as if he thought he could get them, but they only called mockingly to him.
"This is the centre of the castle," said George, as they entered through a ruined doorway into what looked like a great yard, whose stone floor was now overgrown with grass and other weeds.
"Here is where the people used to live. You can see where the rooms were. Look, there's one almost whole there. Go through that little door and you'll see it."
They trooped through a doorway and found themselves in a dark, stone-walled, stone-roofed room with a space at one end where a fireplace must have been. Two slit-like windows lighted the room. It felt very queer and mysterious.
"What a pity it's all broken down," said Julian, wandering out again. "That room seems to be the only one quite whole. There are some others here, but all of them seem to have either no roof or one or other of the walls gone. That room is the only livable one."
"And was there an upstairs to the castle, George?"
"Of course," said George, "but the steps that led up are gone. Look, you can see part of an upstairs room there, by the jackdaw tower. You can't get up to it, though, because I've tried. I nearly broke my neck trying to get up. The stones crumble away so."
"Were there any dungeons?" asked Dick.
"I don't know," said George. "I expect so, but nobody could find them now. Everywhere is so overgrown."
It was indeed overgrown. Big blackberry bushes grew here and there,
and a few gorse bushes forced their way into gaps and corners. The coarse green grass sprang everywhere, and pink thrift grew its cushions in holes and crannies.
"Well, I think it's a perfectly lovely place," said Anne. "Perfectly and absolutely lovely."
"Do you really?" said George, pleased. "I'm so glad. Look, we're right on the other side of the island now, facing the sea. Do you see those rocks with those queer big birds sitting there?" The children looked. They saw some rocks sticking up, with great black shining birds sitting on them in queer positions.
"They are cormorants," said George. "They've caught plenty of fish for their dinner, and they're sitting there digesting it. Hello, they're all flying away. I wonder why."
She soon knew, for from the southwest there suddenly came an ominous rumble.
"Thunder," said George. "That's the storm. It's coming sooner than I thought."
Chapter 6. What the Storm Did. The four children stared out to sea. They had all been so interested in exploring the exciting old castle that not one of them had noticed the sudden change in the weather. Another rumble came. It sounded like a big dog growling in the sky. Tim heard it and growled back, sounding like a small roll of thunder himself.
"My goodness, we're in for it now," said George, half alarmed. "We can't get back in time, that's certain. It's blowing up at top speed. Did you ever see such a change in the sky?"
The sky had been blue when they started. Now it was overcast, and the clouds seemed to hang very low indeed. They scudded along as if someone was chasing them, and the wind howled round in such a mournful way that Anne felt quite frightened.
"It's beginning to rain," said Julian, feeling an enormous drop spatter on his outstretched hand. "We had better shelter, hadn't we, George? We shall get wet through."
"Yes, we will in a minute," said George. "I say, just look at these big waves coming. My word, it really is going to be a storm. Golly, what a flash of lightning!"
The waves were certainly beginning to run very high indeed. It was queer to see what a change had come over them. They swelled up, turned over as soon as they came to the rocks, and then rushed up the beach of the island with a great roar.
"I think we'd better pull our boat up higher still," said George suddenly. "It's going to be a very bad storm indeed. Sometimes these sudden summer storms are worse than a winter one."
She and Julian ran to the other side of the island where they had left the boat. It was a good thing they went, for great waves were already racing right up to it. The two children pulled the boat up almost to the top of the low cliff, and George tied it to a stout gorse bush growing there. By now, the rain was simply pelting down, and George and Julian were soaked.
"I hope the others have been sensible enough to shelter in that room that has a roof and walls," said George.
They were there all right, looking rather cold and scared. It was very dark there, for the only light came through the two slits of windows and the small doorway.
"Could we light a fire to make things a bit more cheerful?" said Julian, looking round. "I wonder where we can find some nice dry sticks."
Almost as if they were answering the question, a small crowd of jackdaws cried out wildly as they circled in the storm.
"Jack! Jack! Jack!"
"Of course, there are plenty of sticks on the ground below the tower," cried Julian. "You know, where the jackdaws nest. They've dropped lots of sticks there."
He dashed out into the rain and ran to the tower. He picked up an armful of sticks and ran back.
"Good," said George. "We'll be able to make a nice fire with those. Anyone got any paper to start it? Or matches?"
"I've got some matches," said Julian. "But nobody's got paper."
"Yes," said Anne suddenly. "The sandwiches are wrapped in paper. Let's undo them, and then we can use the paper for the fire."
"Good idea," said George.
So they undid the sandwiches and put them neatly on a broken stone, rubbing it clean first. Then they built up a fire with the paper underneath and the sticks arranged crisscross on top.
It was fun when they lighted the paper. It flared up and the sticks at once caught fire, for they were very old and dry. Soon there was a fine cracking fire going, and the little ruined room was lighted by dancing flames. It was very dark outside now, for the clouds hung almost low enough to touch the top of the castle tower. And how they raced by! The wind sent them off to the northeast, roaring behind them with a noise like the sea itself.
"I've never, never heard the sea making such an awful noise," said Anne. "Never! It really sounds as if it's shouting at the top of its voice."
What with the howling of the wind and the crashing of the great waves all round the little island, the children could hardly hear themselves speak. They had to shout at one another.
"Let's have our dinner,"
yelled Dick, who was feeling terribly hungry as usual.
"We can't do anything much while this storm lasts."
"Yes, let's," said Anne, looking longingly at the ham sandwiches. "It will be fun to have a picnic round the fire in this dark old room. I wonder how long ago other people had a meal here. I wish I could see them."
"Well, I don't," said Dick, looking round half scared, as if he expected to see the old-time people walk in to share their picnic. "It's quite a queer enough day without wanting things like that to happen."
They all felt better when they were eating the sandwiches and drinking the ginger beer. The fire flared up as more and more sticks caught and gave out quite a pleasant warmth, for now that the wind had got up so strongly, the day had become cold.
"We'll take it in turn to fetch sticks," said George.
But Anne didn't want to go alone. She was trying her best not to show that she was afraid of the storm, but it was more than she could do to go out of the cosy room into the rain and thunder by herself. Tim didn't seem to like the storm either. He sat close by George, his ears cocked, and growled whenever the thunder rumbled. The children fed him with titbits, and he ate them eagerly, for he was hungry too. All the children had 4 biscuits each.
"I think I shall give all mine to Tim," said George. "I didn't bring him any of his own biscuits, and he does seem so hungry."
"No, don't do that," said Julian. "We'll each give him a biscuit. That will be 4 for him, and we'll still have 3 left each. That will be plenty for us."
"You are really nice," said George. "Tim, don't you think they are nice?"
Tim did. He licked everyone and made them laugh. Then he rolled over on his back and let Julian tickle him underneath. The children fed the fire and finished their picnic. When it came to Julian's turn to get more sticks, he disappeared out of the room into the storm. He stood and looked around, the rain wetting his bare head. The storm seemed to be right overhead now. The lightning flashed and the thunder crashed at the same moment. Julian was not a bit afraid of storms, but he couldn't help feeling rather overawed at this one. It was so magnificent. The lightning tore the sky in half almost every minute, and the thunder crashed so loudly that it sounded almost as if mountains were falling down all round. The sea's voice could be heard as soon as the thunder stopped, and that was magnificent to hear too. The spray flew so high into the air that it wetted Julian as he stood in the centre of the ruined castle.
"I really must see what the waves are like," thought the boy. "If the spray flies right over me here, they must be simply enormous."
He made his way out of the castle and climbed up onto part of the ruined wall that had once run all round the castle. He stood up there, looking out to the open sea, and what a sight met his eyes. The waves were like great walls of grey-green. They dashed over the rocks that lay all around the island, and spray flew from them, gleaming white in the stormy sky. They rolled up to the island and dashed themselves against it with such terrific force that Julian could feel the wall beneath his feet tremble with the shock. The boy looked out to sea, marvelling at the really great sight he saw.
For half a moment, he wondered if the sea might come right over the island itself. Then he knew that couldn't happen, for it would have happened before. He stared at the great waves coming in, and then he saw something rather queer. There was something else out on the sea by the rocks, besides the waves. Something dark, something big, something that seemed to lurch out of the waves and settle down again. What could it be? It can't be a ship, said Julian to himself, his heart beginning to beat fast as he strained his eyes to see through the rain and the spray. And yet, it looks more like a ship than anything else. I hope it isn't a ship. There wouldn't be anyone safe from it on this dreadful day. He stood and watched for a while. The dark shape heaved into sight again and then sank away once more. Julian decided to go and tell the others. He ran back to the firelit room.
George, Dick, there's something queer out on the rocks beyond the island, he shouted at the top of his voice. It looks like a ship, and yet it can't possibly be. Come and see.
The others stared at him as so often. Julian led the way to the wall on which he had climbed to watch the sea. Everyone climbed up to gaze out to sea. They saw a great, tumbled, heaving mass of grey-green water with waves rearing up everywhere. Their tops broke over the rocks and they rushed up to the island as if they would gobble it whole. Anne slipped her arm through Julian's. She felt rather small and scared.
You're all right, Anne, said Julian loudly. Now, just watch. You'll see something queer in a minute.
They all watched. At first, they saw nothing, for the waves reared up so high that they hid everything a little way out. Then, suddenly, George saw what Julian meant.
Gracious! She shouted. It is a ship! Yes, it is! Is it being wrecked? Oh, it's a big ship, not a sailing boat or a fishing smack. Oh, is anyone in it? Wailed Anne.
The four children watched, and Tim began to bark as he saw the queer dark shape lurching here and there in the enormous waves. The sea was bringing the ship nearer to shore.
It will be dashed onto those rocks, said Julian suddenly. Look, there it goes.
As he spoke, there came a tremendous crashing, splintering sound, and the dark shape of the ship settled down onto the sharp teeth of the dangerous rocks on the southwest side of the island. It stayed there, shifting only slightly as the big waves ran under it and lifted it a little.
She's stuck there, said Julian. She won't move now. The sea will soon be going down a bit, and then the ship will find herself held by those rocks.
As he spoke, a ray of pale sunshine came wavering out between a gap in the thinning clouds. It was gone almost at once.
Good, said Dick, looking upwards. The sun will be out again soon. We can warm ourselves then and get dry. And maybe we can find out what that poor ship is. Oh, Julian, I do so hope there was nobody in it. I hope they've all taken to boats and got safely to land.
The clouds thinned out a little more. The wind stopped roaring and dropped to a steady breeze. The sun shone out again for a longer time, and the children felt its welcome warmth. They all stared at the ship on the rocks. The sun shone on it and lighted it up.
There's something queer about it somehow, said Julian slowly. Something awfully queer. I've never seen a ship quite like it.
George was staring at it with a strange look in her eyes. She turned to face the three children, and they were astonished to see the bright gleam in her blue eyes. The girl looked almost too excited to speak.
What is it?
Asked Julian, catching hold of her hand.
Julian! Oh, Julian! It's my wreck! She cried in a high, excited voice. Don't you see what's happened? The storm has lifted the ship up from the bottom of the sea and has lodged it onto those rocks. It's my wreck!
The others saw at once that she was right. It was the old wrecked ship.
No wonder it looked queer.
No wonder it looked so old and dark and such a strange shape. It was the wreck lifted high out of its sleeping place and put on the rocks nearby.
George, we shall be able to row out and get into the wreck now, shouted Julian. We shall be able to explore it from end to end. We may find the boxes of gold. Oh, George!
Chapter 7. Back to Kirin Cottage. The four children were so tremendously surprised and excited that for a minute or two they didn't say a word. They just stared at the dark hulk of the old wreck, imagining what they might find. Then Julian clutched George's arm and pressed it tightly.
"Isn't this wonderful?" he said. "Oh, George, isn't it an extraordinary thing to happen?"
Still George said nothing, but stared at the wreck, all kinds of thoughts racing through her mind. Then she turned to Julian.
"If only the wreck is still mine, now it's thrown up like this," she said. "I don't know if wrecks belong to the Queen or anyone like Lost Treasure does, but after all, the ship did belong to our family. Nobody bothered much about it when it was down under the sea, but do you suppose people will still let me have it for my own, now it's thrown up?"
"Well, don't let's tell anyone," said Dick.
"Don't be silly," said George.
"One of the fishermen is sure to see it when his ship goes slipping out of the bay. The news will soon be out."
"Well then, we'd better explore it thoroughly ourselves before anyone else does," said Dick eagerly. "No one knows about it yet, only us. Can't we explore it as soon as the waves go down a bit?"
"We can't wade out to the rocks, if that's what you mean," said George. "We might get there by boat, but we couldn't possibly risk it now while the waves are so big. They won't go down today, that's certain. The wind is still too strong."
"Well, what about tomorrow morning early," said Julian, "before anyone has got to know about it? I bet if only we can get into the ship first, we can find anything there is to find."
"Yes, I expect we could," said George. "I told you divers had been down and explored the ship as thoroughly as they could, but of course it is difficult to do that properly underwater. We might find something they've missed."
"Oh, this is like a dream. I can't believe it's true that my..."
said George, patting him. "It won't hurt you. What do you think it is?"
"He probably thinks it's a whale," said Anne with a laugh.
"Oh, George, this is the most exciting day of my life. Oh, can't we possibly take the boat and see if we can get to the wreck?"
"No, we can't," said George. "I only wish we could, but it's quite impossible, Anne. For one thing, I don't think the wreck has quite settled down on the rocks yet, and maybe it won't till the tide has gone down. I can see it lifting a little still when an extra big wave comes. It would be dangerous to go into it yet. And for another thing, I don't want my boat smashed to bits on the rocks and us thrown into that wild water. That's what would happen. We must wait till tomorrow. It's a good idea to come early. I expect lots of grown-ups will think it's their business to explore it."
The children watched the old wreck for a little time longer and then went all round the island again. It was certainly not very large, but it really was exciting, with its rocky little coast, its quiet inlet where their boat was, the ruined castle, the circling jackdaws, and the scampering rabbits everywhere.
"I do love it," said Anne. "I really do. It's just small enough to feel like an island. Most islands are too big to feel like islands. I mean, Britain is an island, but nobody living on it could possibly know it unless they were told. Now, this island really feels like one because wherever you are, you can see to the other side of it. I love it."
George felt very happy. She had often been on her island before, but always alone, except for Tim. She had always vowed that she never, never would take anyone there because it would spoil her island for her. But it hadn't been spoilt. It had made it much nicer. For the first time,
George began to understand that sharing pleasures doubles their joy.
"We'll wait till the waves go down a bit, then we'll go back home," she said. "I rather think there's some more rain coming, and we'll only get soaked through. We shan't be back till tea time as it is, because we'll have a long pull against the outgoing tide."
All the children felt a little tired after the excitements of the morning. They said very little as they rowed home. Everyone took turns at rowing, except Anne, who was not strong enough with the oars to row against the tide. They looked back at the island as they left it. They couldn't see the wreck, because that was on the opposite side, facing the open sea.
"It's just as well it's there," said Julian. "No one can see it yet. Only when a boat goes out to fish will it be seen. And we shall be there as early as any boat goes out. I vote we get up at dawn."
"Well, that's pretty early," said George. "Can you wake up? I'm often out at dawn, but you're not used to it."
"Of course we can wake up," said Julian. "Well, here we are back at the beach again, and I'm jolly glad. My arms are awfully tired, and I'm so hungry, I could eat a whole larder full of things."
"Woof,"
said Tim, quite agreeing.
"I'll have to take Tim to Alf," said George, jumping out of the boat. "You get the boat in, Julian. I'll join you in a few minutes."
It wasn't long before all four were sitting down to a good tea. Aunt Fanny had baked new scones for them and had made a ginger cake with black treacle. It was dark brown and sticky to eat. The children finished it all up and said it was the nicest they had ever tasted.
"Did you have an exciting day?" asked their aunt.
"Oh, yes," said Anne eagerly. "The storm was grand. It threw up..."
Julian and Dick both kicked her under the table. George couldn't reach her, or she would most certainly have kicked her too. Anne stared at the boys angrily, with tears in her eyes.
"Now, what's the matter?" asked Aunt Fanny. "Did somebody kick you, Anne? Well, really, this kicking under the table has got to stop. Poor Anne will be covered with bruises. What did the sea throw up, dear?"
"It threw up the most enormous waves," said Anne, looking defiantly at the others.
She knew they had thought she was going to say that the sea had thrown up the wreck, but they were wrong. They had kicked her for nothing.
"Sorry for kicking you, Anne," said Julian. "My foot sort of slipped."
"So did mine," said Dick. "Yes, Aunt Fanny, it was a magnificent sight on the island. The waves raced up that little inlet, and we had to take our boat almost up to the top of the low cliff there."
"I wasn't really afraid of the storm," said Anne. "In fact, I wasn't really as afraid of it as Tim..."
Everybody knew perfectly well that Anne was going to mention Timothy, and they all interrupted her at once, speaking very loudly. Julian managed to get a kick in again.
"Ooh!" said Anne.
"The rabbits were so tame," said Julian loudly.
"We watched the cormorants," said Dick.
And George joined in too, talking at the same time.
"The jackdaws made such a noise. They said, 'Jack! Jack! Jack!' all the time."
"Well, really, you sound like jackdaws yourselves talking all at once like this," said Aunt Fanny with a laugh. "Now, have you all finished? Very well, then. Go and wash your sticky hands. Yes, George, I know they're sticky because I made that gingerbread and you've had 3 slices. Then you had better go and play quietly in the other room because it's raining and you can't go out. But don't disturb your father, George. He's very busy." The children went to wash.
"Idiot," said Julian to Anne. "Nearly gave us away twice."
"I didn't mean what you thought I meant the first time,"
began Anne indignantly.
George interrupted her. "I'd rather you gave the secret of the wreck away than my secret about Tim," she said. "I do think you've got a careless tongue."
"Yes, I have," said Anne sorrowfully.
"I think I'd better not talk at mealtimes any more. I love Tim so much, I just can't seem to help wanting to talk about him."
They all went to play in the other room. Julian turned a table upside down with a crash.
"We'll play at wrecks," he said.
This is the wreck. Now, we're going to explore it.
The door flew open and an angry, frowning face looked in. It was George's father.
What was that noise?
He said.
George, did you overturn that table?
I did, said Julian. I'm sorry, sir. I quite forgot you were working.
Any more noise like that, and I shall keep you all in bed tomorrow, said his uncle Quentin. Georgina, keep your cousins quiet.
The door shut, and Uncle Quentin went out. The children looked at one another.
Your father's awfully fierce, isn't he? Said Julian. Oh, I'm sorry I made that row. I didn't think.
We'd better do something really quiet, said George, or he'll keep his word, and we'll find ourselves in bed tomorrow, just when we want to explore the wreck. This was a terrible thought. Anne went to get one of her dolls to play with. She had managed to bring quite a number after all. Julian fetched a book. George took up a beautiful little boat she was carving out of a piece of wood. Dick lay back on a chair and thought of the exciting wreck. The rain poured down steadily, and everyone hoped it would have stopped by the morning.
"We'll have to be up most awfully early,"
said Dick, yawning.
"What about going to bed in good time tonight? I'm tired with all that rowing."
In the ordinary way, none of the children liked going to bed early. But with such an exciting thing to look forward to, early bed seemed different that night.
"It will make the time go quickly," said Anne, putting down her doll. "Shall we go now?"
"Whatever do you suppose Mother would say if we went just after tea?" said George. "She'd think we were all ill. No, let's go after supper. We'll just say we're tired with rowing, which is perfectly true, and we'll get a good night's sleep and be ready for our adventure tomorrow morning. And it is an adventure, you know. It isn't many people that have the chance of exploring an old, old wreck like that, which has always been at the bottom of the sea."
So by 8 o'clock, all the children were in bed, rather to Aunt Fanny's surprise. Anne fell asleep at once. Julian and Dick were not long, but George lay awake for some time, thinking of her island, her wreck, and, of course, her beloved dog.
"I must take Tim, too," she thought as she fell asleep. "We can't leave old Tim out of this. He shall share in the adventure, too."
Chapter 8. Exploring the Wreck. Julian woke first the next morning. He awoke just as the sun was slipping over the horizon in the east and filling the sky with gold. Julian stared at the ceiling for a moment, and then, in a rush, he remembered all that had happened the day before. He sat up straight in bed and whispered as loudly as he could.
"Dick, wake up! We're going to see the wreck! Oh, do wake up!"
Dick woke and grinned at Julian. A feeling of happiness crept over him. They were going on an adventure. He leapt out of bed and ran quietly to the girls' room. He opened the door. Both the girls were fast asleep. Anne curled up like a dormouse under the sheet. Dick shook George and then dug Anne in the back. They awoke and sat up.
"Buck up," whispered Dick. "The sun is just rising. We'll have to hurry."
George's blue eyes shone as she dressed. Anne skipped about quietly, finding her few clothes, just a bathing suit, jeans and jersey, and rubber shoes for her feet. It wasn't many minutes before they were all ready.
"Now, not a creak on the stairs, not a cough or a giggle," warned Julian as they stood together on the landing.
Anne was a dreadful giggler, and had often given secret plans away by her sudden explosive choke. But this time, the little girl was as solemn as the others and as careful. They crept down the stairs and undid the little front door. Not a sound was made. They shut the door quietly and made their way down the garden path to the gate. The gate always creaked, so they climbed over it instead of opening it. The sun was now shining brightly, though it was still low in the eastern sky. It felt warm already. The sky was so beautifully blue that Anne couldn't help feeling it had been freshly washed.
"It looks just as if it had come back from the laundry," she told the others.
They squealed with laughter at her. She did say odd things at times, but they knew what she meant. The day had a lovely new feeling about it. The clouds were so pink in the bright blue sky, and the sea looked so smooth and fresh. It was impossible to imagine that it had been so rough the day before. George got her boat. Then she went to get Tim, while the boys hauled the boat down to the sea. Alf, the fisher boy, was surprised to see George so early. He was about to go with his father fishing. He grinned at George.
"You going fishing too?" he said to her. "My, wasn't that a storm yesterday? I thought you'd be caught in it."
"We were," said George. "Come on, Tim, come on."
Tim was very pleased to see George so early. He capered round her as she ran back to the others, almost tripping her up as she went. He leapt into the boat as soon as he saw it and stood at the stern, his red tongue out, his tail wagging violently.
"I wonder his tail keeps on," said Anne, looking at it. "One day, Timothy, you'll wag it right off."
They set off to the island. It was easy to row now because the sea was so calm. They came to the island and rowed around it to the other side. And there was the wreck, piled high on some sharp rocks. It had settled down now and did not stir as waves slid under it. It lay a little to one side, and the broken mast, now shorter than before, stuck out at an angle.
"There she is," said Julian in excitement. "Poor old wreck. I guess she's a bit more battered now. What a noise she made when she went crashing onto those rocks yesterday."
"How do we get to her?"
asked Anne, looking at the mass of ugly, sharp rocks all around. But George was not at all dismayed. She knew almost every inch of the coast around her little island. She pulled steadily at the oars and soon came near to the rocks in which the great wreck rested. The children looked at the wreck from their boat. It was big, much bigger than they had imagined when they had peered at it from the top of the water. It was encrusted with shellfish of some kind, and strands of brown and green seaweed hung down. It smelt queer. It had great holes in its sides, showing where it had battered against the rocks. There were holes in the deck, too. Altogether, it looked a sad and forlorn old ship. But to the four children, it was the most exciting thing in the whole world. They rowed to the rocks on which the wreck lay. The tide washed over them. George took a look round.
"We'll tie our boat up to the wreck itself," she said. "And we'll get onto the deck quite easily by climbing up the side. Look, Julian, throw this loop of rope over that broken bit of wood there, sticking out from the side."
Julian did as he was told. The rope tightened and the boat was held in position. Then George clambered up the side of the wreck like a monkey. She was a marvel at climbing. Julian and Dick followed her, but Anne had to be helped up. Soon, all four were standing on the slanting deck. It was slippery with seaweed, and the smell was very strong indeed. Anne didn't like it.
"Well, this was the deck," said George, "and that's where the men got up and down."
She pointed to a large hole. They went to it and looked down. The remains of an iron ladder were still there. George looked at it.
"I think it's still strong enough to hold us," she said. "I'll go first. Anyone got a torch? It looks pretty dark down there."
Julian had a torch. He handed it to George. The children became rather quiet. It was mysterious somehow to look down into the dark inside of the big ship. What would they find? George switched on the torch and then swung herself down the ladder. The others followed. The light from the torch showed a very queer sight. The underparts of the ship were low-ceilinged, made of thick oak. The children had to bend their heads to get about. It seemed as if there were places that might have been cabins, though it was difficult to tell now, for everything was so battered, sea-drenched and seaweedy. The smell was really horrid, though it was mostly of drying seaweed. The children slipped about on the seaweed as they went round the inside of the ship. It didn't seem so big inside after all. There was a big hold under the cabins, which the children saw by the light of their torch.
"That's where the boxes of gold would have been kept, I expect," said Julian.
But there was nothing in the hold except water and fish. The children couldn't go down because the water was too deep. One or two barrels floated in the water, but they had burst open and were quite empty. "I expect they were water barrels or barrels of pork or biscuit," said George. "Let's go round the other part of the ship again, where the cabins are. Isn't it strange to see bunks there that sailors have slept in? And look at that old wooden chair. Fancy it still being here after all those years. Look at the things on those hooks, too. They're all rusty now and covered with seaweedy stuff. But they must have been the cook's pans and dishes." It was a very queer trip round the old wreck. The children were all on the lookout for boxes which might contain bars of gold. But there didn't seem to be one single box of any kind anywhere. They came to a rather bigger cabin than the others. It had a bunk in one corner in which a large crab rested. An old bit of furniture, looking rather like a table with two legs, all encrusted with greyish shells, lay against the bunk. Wooden shelves, festooned with grey-green seaweed, hung crookedly on the walls of the cabin.
"This must have been the captain's own cabin," said Julian. "It's the biggest one. Look, what's that in the corner?"
"An old cup," said Anne, picking it up. "And here's half of a saucer. I expect the captain was sitting here having a cup of tea when the ship went down."
This made the children feel rather queer. It was dark and smelly in the little cabin, and the floor was wet and slippery to their feet. George began to feel that her wreck was really more pleasant sunk under the water than raised above it.
"Let's go," she said with a shiver. "I don't like it much. It is exciting, I know, but it's a bit frightening too."
They turned to go. Julian flashed his torch round the little cabin for the last time. He was about to switch it off and follow the others up to the deck above when he caught sight of something that made him stop. He flashed his torch onto it and then called to the others.
"I say, wait a bit. There's a cupboard here in the wall. Let's see if there's anything in it."
The others turned back and looked. They saw what looked like a small cupboard let in level with the wall of the cabin. What had caught Julian's eye was the keyhole. There was no key there, though.
"There just might be something inside," said Julian.
He tried to prise open the wooden door with his fingers, but it wouldn't move.
"Oh, it's locked," he said. "Of course it would be."
"I expect the lock is rotten by now," said George, and she tried too.
Then she took out her big, strong pocket knife and inserted it between the cupboard door and the cabin wall. She forced back the blade, and the lock of the cupboard suddenly snapped. As she had said, it was quite rotten. The door swung open, and the children saw a shelf inside with a few curious things on it. There was a wooden box, swollen with the wet seawater in which it had lain for years. There were two or three things that looked like old pulpy books. There was some sort of glass drinking vessel, cracked in half, and two or three funny objects so spoiled by seawater that no one could possibly say what they were.
"Nothing very interesting, except the box," said Julian, and he picked it up. "Anyway, I expect that whatever is inside is ruined, but we may as well try and open it."
He and George tried their best to force the lock of the old wooden box. On the top of it were stamped initials, H.J.K.
"I expect those were the captain's initials," said Dick.
"No, they were the initials of my great-great-great-grandfather," said George, her eyes shining suddenly. "I've heard all about him. His name was Henry John Kirin,
This was his ship, you know. This must have been his very private box in which he kept his old papers or diaries. Oh, we simply must open it. But it was quite impossible to force the lid up with the tools they had there. They soon gave it up, and Julian picked up the box to carry it to the boat.
"We'll open it at home," he said, his voice sounding rather excited. "We'll get a hammer or something and get it open somehow. Oh, George, this really is a find."
They all of them felt that they really had something mysterious in their possession. Was there anything inside the box? And if so, what would it be? They longed to get home and open it. They went up on deck, climbing the old iron ladder. As soon as they got there, they saw that others besides themselves had discovered that the wreck had been thrown up from the bottom of the sea.
"Golly! Half the fishing smacks of the bay have discovered it," cried Julian, looking round at the fishing boats that had come as near as they dared to the wreck.
The fishermen were looking at the wreck in wonder. When they saw the children on board, they hallooed. The four children got into their boat and rowed home as fast as they could. It was past their breakfast time. They might get a good scolding. They might even be sent to bed by George's fierce father. But what did they care? They had explored the wreck and had come away with a box which might contain, well, if not... Tim had been left with the fisher boy, or rather had been tied up in his backyard, for Alf had gone out fishing and was even now gazing from his father's boat at the strange wreck.
"We can make a bit of money taking sightseers out to this wreck," said Alf.
And before the day was out, scores of interested people had seen the old wreck from the decks of motorboats and fishing smacks. George was furious about it, but she couldn't do anything. After all, as Julian said, anybody could have a look.
Chapter 9. The Box from the Wreck. The first thing that the children did after breakfast was to fetch the precious box and take it out to the tool shed in the garden. They were simply longing to force it open. All of them secretly felt certain that it would hold treasure of some sort. Julian looked round for a tool. He found a chisel and decided that would be just the thing to force the box open. He tried, but the tool slipped and jabbed his fingers. Then he tried other things, but the box obstinately refused to open. The children stared at it crossly.
"I know what to do," said Anne at last. "Let's take it to the top of the house and throw it down to the ground. It will burst open then, I expect."
The others thought over the idea.
"It might be worth trying," said Julian. "The only thing is, it might break or spoil anything inside the box."
But there didn't seem any other way to open the box, so Julian carried it up to the top of the house. He went to the attic and opened the window there. The others were down below, waiting. Julian hurled the box out of the window as violently as he could. It flew through the air and landed with a terrific crash on the crazy paving below. At once the French window there opened, and their Uncle Quentin came out like a bullet from a gun.
"Whatever are you doing?" he cried. "Surely you aren't throwing things at each other out of the window. What's this on the ground?"
The children looked at the box. It had burst open and lay on the ground, showing a tin lining that was waterproof. Whatever was in the box would not be spoilt. It would be quite dry. Dick ran to pick it up.
"I said, what's this on the ground?" shouted his uncle and moved towards him.
It's something that belongs to us," said Dick, going red.
"Well, I shall take it away from you," said his uncle. "Disturbing me like this, give it to me. Where did you get it?"
Nobody answered. Uncle Quentin frowned till his glasses nearly fell off.
"Where did you get it?"
he barked, glaring at poor Anne, who was nearest.
Out of the wreck," stammered the little girl, scared.
"Out of the wreck?" said her uncle in surprise. "The old wreck that was thrown up yesterday?
I've heard about that. Do you mean to say you've been in it?
Yes, said Dick.
Julian joined them at that moment, looking worried. It would be too awful if his uncle took the box just as they got it open. But that was exactly what he did do.
Well, this box may contain something important, he said,
and he took it from Dick's hands.
You've no right to go prying about in that old wreck. You might take something that mattered.
Well, it's my wreck, said George in a defiant tone. Please, Father, let us have the box. We just got it opened. We thought it might hold a gold bar or something like that.
A gold bar, said her father with a snort. What a baby you are. This small box would never hold a thing like that. It's much more likely to contain particulars of what happened to the bars. I have always thought that the gold was safely delivered somewhere, and that the ship, empty of its valuable cargo, got wrecked as it left the bay.
Oh, Father, please, please let us have our box, begged George, almost in tears. She suddenly felt certain that it did contain papers that might tell them what had happened to the gold. But without another word, her father turned and went into the house, carrying the box, burst open and cracked, its tin lining showing through under his arm. Anne burst into tears.
Don't blame me for telling him we got it from the wreck, she sobbed. Please don't. He glared at me so. I just had to tell him.
All right, baby, said Julian, putting his arm round Anne. He looked furious. He thought it was very unfair of his uncle to take the box like that. Listen, I'm not going to stand this. We'll get hold of that box somehow and look into it. I'm sure your father won't bother himself with it, George. He'll start writing his book again and forget all about it. I'll wait my chance and slip into his study and get it, even if it means a spanking if I'm discovered.
Good, said George. We'll all keep a watch and see if Father goes out. So they took it in turns to keep watch. But most annoyingly, their Uncle Quentin remained in his study all the morning. Aunt Fanny was surprised to see one or two children always about the garden that day, instead of down on the beach.
"Why don't you all keep together and bathe or do something?" she said. "Have you quarrelled with one another?"
"No," said Dick. "Of course not."
But he didn't say why they were in the garden.
"Doesn't your father ever go out?"
he said to George, when it was her turn to keep watch.
"I don't think he leads a very healthy life."
"Scientists never do," said George, as if she knew all about them. "But I tell you what, he may go to sleep this afternoon. He sometimes does." Julian was left behind in the garden that afternoon. He sat down under a tree and opened a book. Soon, he heard a curious noise that made him look up. He knew at once what it was.
"That's Uncle Quentin snoring," he said in excitement. "It is. Oh, I wonder if I could possibly creep in at the French window and get our box."
He stole to the windows and looked in. One was a little way open, and Julian opened it a little more. He saw his uncle lying back in a comfortable armchair, his mouth a little open, his eyes closed, fast asleep. Every time he took a breath, he snored.
"Well, he really does look sound asleep," thought the boy. "And there's the box just behind him on that table. I'll risk it. I bet I'll get an awful spanking if I'm caught, but I can't help that."
He stole in. His uncle still snored. He tiptoed by him to the table behind his uncle's chair. He took hold of the box. And then a bit of the broken wood of the box fell to the floor with a thud. His uncle stirred in his chair and opened his eyes. Quick as lightning, the boy crouched down behind his uncle's chair, hardly breathing.
"What's that?"
he heard his uncle say. Julian didn't move. Then his uncle settled down again and shut his eyes. Soon there was the sound of his rhythmic snoring.
"Hooray!" thought Julian. "He's off again."
Quietly, he stood up, holding the box. On tiptoe, he crept to the French window. He slipped out and ran softly down the garden path. He didn't think of hiding the box. All he wanted to do was to get to the other children and show them what he had done. He ran to the beach where the others were lying in the sun.
"Hi!" he yelled. "Hi! I've got it! I've got it!"
They all sat up with a jerk, thrilled to see the box in Julian's arms. They forgot all about the other people on the beach. Julian dropped down on the sand and grinned.
"Your father went to sleep," he said to George. "Oh, Tim, don't lick me like that."
"And George, I went in and a bit of the box dropped on the floor and it woke him up."
"Golly," said George. "What happened?"
"I crouched down behind his chair till he went to sleep again," said Julian. "Then I fled. Now, let's see what's in here.
I don't believe your father's even tried to see."
He hadn't. The tin lining was intact. It had rusted with the years of lying in the wet, and the lid was so tightly fitted down that it was almost impossible to move it. But once George began to work at it with her pocket knife, scraping away the rust, it began to loosen, and in about a quarter of an hour, it came off. The children bent eagerly over it. Inside lay some old papers and a book of some kind with a black cover. Nothing else at all. No bar of gold. No treasure. Everyone felt a little disappointed.
"It's all quite dry," said Julian, surprised. "Not a bit damp. The tin lining kept everything perfect."
He picked up the book and opened it.
"It's a diary your great-great-great-grandfather kept of the ship's voyages," he said. "I can hardly read the writing. It's so small and funny."
End of disc 2.